service back to work several times, and thus ending any collective action. The rush to legislate has been one of the main thorns causing the animosity between teachers and the provincial government, be it the Socreds, the NDP, or the Liberals. For their part, the teachers have resorted to illegal strikes, work slowdowns, and other tactics. To varying degrees, everyone shoulders a little blame. So there's very little trust on either side, at least from their own perspective. I think my sympathies lie more with the teachers for reasons we'll discover later. Ostensibly, the government says it can't afford to meet the teachers' demands. The teachers say they can't work under the conditions that they're forced to. And of course, the third branch, often understated, students cannot learn under the current conditions. There are a lot of minor issues that most analysts think will not be hard to arbitrate once the big issues are resolved. Some minor issues, though, have been brought up that tends to make the teacher's side more believable, well, based upon comments Premier Christy Clark made. She stated that the union was demanding unlimited massages, of the therapeutic relaxing nature. No, not those erotic ones. The minds of some of my listeners. And that was one of the reasons she could not sign the contract with the teachers. Well, no such demand was made. Well, not worded in that way. The union wanted to increase teachers suffering from chronic physical pain to avail $3,000 in therapeutic massage. That would work out to be about 2 visits per month. However, the union had already negotiated itself down to just a $200 increase, which is currently about $500. That works out to 6 visits a year. For those suffering chronic pain, that's a big difference. Another claim Christy Clark made was the teachers demanded another day off work with pay. OMG, those bastards. I'd love to be able to get a day off from my job and get paid. Really, anyone would. Of course, what Clark calls a day off work, the teachers call preparation time. If you only pay teachers for the time they were with the students, well, when would they have time to mark school work? When do they have time to design lesson plans? When are they supposed to learn what it is new in their subject matter that they're supposed to be teaching their students? And what about teaching development itself? How are they supposed to make sure that they are being the best possible teacher they can be? This is not a day off work. It's a day of work without students, so they can be better prepared to teach those students. From what research I can find, secondary teachers get about 3 hours of prep time a week, compared to other provinces, over 4 hours in Saskatchewan, over 6 hours in Toronto, 6.5 in my birth town, Brandon, Manitoba, 7 hours in Quebec. It doesn't seem that much of an ask. And to be fair, not all teachers will use this time effectively, but it should be made available for those teachers who need the time. There's always going to be some people abusing the system. I don't think that's a reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So those are the minor issues that are likely to be put to bed once the two major issues are resolved. The first one is, of course, money. In that press conference, Clark claimed the teachers were asking for an unprecedented 8% increase over 5 years. That is better than the other government employees who are getting anywhere from 2 to 4% increase a year. But that a year bit, it's important. Because when you factor in that the Liberal government legislated a 3-year contract in 2010 that had 0% increase, the actual increase to teachers compared to other workers is about 1% over the period of time. Essentially, the teachers are not only negotiating the pay increase for this contract, but for the absence of an increase in the previous contract, a contract that was imposed upon them. I should note that the government is not using the 8% number, but 15. Why? Well, they use the cost of living increase as well as the actual increase in wage. On the one hand, that's fair, vis-a-vis the total cost of the province. But it's also a tad misleading. If my wage stays the same, but everything I buy increases, I've actually taken an effective wage reduction. Keeping the wage at pace with inflation is not a raise. So on that basis, the 8% number is the real number we should be using. Now, there are things that are not figured into that number. For instance, the signing bonus, another thing prominent in the coverage of this issue. The number stated was 5 grand, then 3 grand. Although that may seem important in the figuring of the final numbers, that does bring up the cost to the teachers. Well, first, I should point out that it is unlikely any agreement will include back pay. So the signing bonus is sort of compensation for the teachers for the time that they were, quote, out of work. This issue is important to the union, because a number of teachers are complaining the strike is costing them too much, that they are finding it hard to make ends meet. The unions want to keep the signing bonus to keep its members happy for the next time there's a call to action. Now, some of my listeners may have little sympathy for the professionals who make a medium income of $50,000 to $60,000 a year. Okay, this is debatable. But considering how important the future is, and our children are our future, I am unsure I want to see these people being the lowest paid members of society. I will point out the median income in this country is $50,000. So they're not being overpaid, but they're not being underpaid either. That said, this apparent need, you be the judge, has caused a positive social movement. A number of parents are setting up social support groups for the teachers, things like food banks and the like, to help teachers survive the desert that is the pre-signing time frame. Again, irrespective of whether you think they need it or not, I think this is positive because even if you think the teachers are fat cats, it's a marker of social solidarity, and perhaps unconsciously a nod that unions tend to set the context for wages and benefits for the rest of us. You may think a mid-ranked teacher being paid $55,000 a year is too much, but it is against that wage that other people can demand a better wage in their own negotiations with their employer. It is a more reliable example of the rising tide raises all boats. Studies show the stronger the union movement in a community slash country, the better off non-union employees are. Better pay, working conditions, benefits. Oh yes. And when we factor in the cost, we should also include the government's generous offer of $40 per kid under 12 per day. I think it's 12. Well, with about 300,000 kids falling into this group, that means the government is spending $12 million a day. In 10 days, that would pay for the demand for wage increase. In 20 days, it would pay for the class size reductions. How much is too much? Well, there are some who think that this is the government's attempt to break the union, that they are willing to pay any price, except the one needed to repair our educational system, pay any price to finally be done with this troublesome union. Oh, and that leads us nicely into the other sticking point in negotiations. Remember I mentioned earlier how the NDP repaired the relationship with the teachers, and then how the Liberals shite on it? One of the biggest issues the teacher had was class size and composition. Okay, now for a confession. When I went to school, well, everyone was, quote, normal. What does that mean? Well, you may have had a, quote, native in the class, watch out for your lunch money. Sorry, but I grew up in a time when you just knew that they would steal, that their parents drank Lysol. And I'm not proud of this, and I hope I've evolved beyond it. But such was the day. The point being that, well, again, I say with much embarrassment, retards, sorry, I know that's an offensive term, but it was a term used at the time, that they were quarantined from the, quote, normal kids. If my memory can be trusted, we had four or five rows of about five desks, so we had a class size of maybe 25. Of course, if you were a dumb kid, you were put into the, quote, special class for the feeble-minded. Again, language of the time. So a teacher in my day had a rather homogeneous student body. That is, everyone was more or less on the same level. Now, though we have evolved, well, based on our current understanding, it is now understood that this is better for everyone to integrate kids into a single social group. So with minor exceptions, special kids, can I say special? Is that politically correct? Normal kids are now referred to as typical because there is no normal, nor has there ever been. Anyway, special need kids are kept with their peers. The thinking being that everyone gains from the diversity, something I would agree with to a point. This means that a teacher is not only expected to master the subject matter they are teaching, but needs to understand child psychology, nothing new, but also about abnormal psychology, something a teacher in my day need not worry about. How do you teach a child with ADHD, with autism spectrum disorder, with, well, you get the idea. Another challenge from my day is, well, we all spoke one language, English. Yes, we had those weirdos who had learned French and even bigger nerds who took Latin, but everyone was fluent in English. We have embraced multiculturalism, BC and Vancouver more so than most. So now, not only does a teacher have to deal with developmental issues, but the fact that a portion of their class may literally not understand a word they are saying. It is this cacophony that is at the root of the other major demand by the Teachers Federation. Control over, well, not control over, but power to negotiate class size and composition. And here's where we have the biggest roadblock. From what I've learned, while teachers are willing to give on almost all the issues, they feel that this one is both bad for the teachers and harmful for society. It has been the root of their successful court challenges. So in the modern class, you do not have a lot of European kids speaking English. You can find that half the class have English as a second language, and several that speak almost no English at all. How the hell can you teach them if they don't know what you're saying? You also have to deal with kids with special needs, be it cerebral palsy or Down syndrome. Note, often teachers are given minimal assistance to help deal with these special needs students. And on a personal note, I think integrating these people into society is a part of positive evolution of our culture. That said, there are limits. Limits, I say? What do I mean, you ask? Well, if you have 30 kids in a class and 10 of them are special needs, but you only have two assistants, well, that affects the quality of instruction every student gets. If you think integration is positive, as I do, then you need to supply sufficient support to make the ideal work. Here, the government seems to think quarantining students, like they did in my day, may be the most cost-effective, if interested society as a whole. Oh yes, and lastly, there are those kids who have, well, what we would have called in the old day, issues. Now we call them ADHD, autism, dyslexia, what have you. These are not big ailments that merit teaching assistance, but something the teacher must address in a modern classroom. So in one example, a class was informally divided into four groups. One, with developmental issues like autism, they got a teaching assistant. Another group has language issues. They get a teaching assistant. Another had ADHD and other control issues. They were the most challenging, and the teacher dealt with them directly. And the fourth group? That group would be your sort of average class in my day. They would receive self-directed instructions. That is, teach yourself. Depending on the quality of the assistants, the first three groups may not get proper help. Many assistants are assigned based on seniority. I mean, let's remember, teachers are people too. And those left to self-learn are often left under-challenged and not stimulated, and they find their education boring. Now, one of the reasons for the necessity of dividing the class into subgroups, which I assume my loyal listeners have already ascertained, is that the class is too big to begin with. If the classes were half the size, the teacher, with some assistance, could ensure every student got their fair share of attention, that everyone was challenged and gained the education all civilized people have a right to. I find it funny for those parents who, with some understandable frustration, want the teachers to, quote, get back to class, my kid needs to get a good education. They cannot do that if you're striking. Well, therein lies the rub, a good education. You may say, get back to work, but if the only teachers you can get to work at that wage, under those conditions, well, what kind of education are you giving your child? Sure, you can go to a private school and pay twice as much in tuition than you would in taxes if only the government had did its job and provided proper support for our teachers and cut the funding it gives willingly to LNG and fish farms. Ironically, the last two are big campaign donors to the Liberals. I am sure that has nothing to do with Clark's reluctance to provide proper compensation to teachers who strengthen our society versus the corporations that strengthen Liberal coffers. So here we are, a Liberal provincial government that does not care as much about the children of BC as it does about LNG, where it will hand over $10 billion, that's B with a billion, for LNG. But when it comes to providing 1/12 of that for the future of BC, for the children of this province, well, Clark seems to have an attitude, we can afford natural gas, but not students. In an interesting twist, it seems students are beginning to protest the strike. They want to remind everyone that there's a third party to this debate, the students. Everyone is talking about the teacher's point and the government's counterpoint, but no one is asking the students what they want. So this Monday, several students experienced a walk-in where mostly grade 12 students worried about their post-grad placement took over some schools, walked to the MLA office, and basically wanted the press to know that they have a stake in these negotiations too. So far, they're taking a neutral approach to the problem. I suspect they agree with the teachers on class size and composition, but perhaps are sympathetic to the government on wages. But the point being, they have a stake in these negotiations, and that both sides had better come to some agreement because the only ones truly suffering, who have the most to lose, are the students. The union has stated recently that it is willing to drop the class size and competition issue until it has finished winding its way through the courts. It's expected to ultimately end up at the Supreme Court, and that they will agree to binding arbitration over the wage and benefit issues. The government's stance is basically there will be no contract until the teachers give up the court case, a case they have consistently won. Once they have relinquished, to put in the words of the BC Teachers Federation head, only after they give up their constitutional rights will the government talk about wages and any kind of contract. If you voted for the provincial Liberals, Well, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. And in this contract, you get a dumber generation and more global warming. Great call. To paraphrase a common mantra on the show, never forget, 2017. Really? 2017? Feck. We'll be back after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back. We're going to try a little something different here, kind of a Dawn ramble. There's been a few interesting things that have come up recently that I think merit comment on, but I'm not sure it's worth a full segment. One of the interesting things I came across the other day was about a week ago, the Canadian Automobile Machine Gun Gun Brigade, also known as Brunton-Ales Brigade, was formed. What made it so special? Well, it was Canadian. And it was the first mechanized unit in the British Army. That's right. The first all mechanized, truly modern kind of transportation element in the British Army was Canadian. Now, these cars were, well, not exactly the best things in the world. One of the things notably absent was, although it had armor all around and it had machine guns, it lacked any kind of top on it. In fact, it was so bad that the driver had to sort of peek his head over the armor plating in order to see where he was driving. Now, that being said, these units actually did not too bad. They're actually famously credited with helping repel one of the last great German assaults in 1918. Another thing I've come across recently that I thought was kind of interesting was in this date, Dennis Ritchie was born in 1941. Who's Dennis Ritchie? You don't know? Well, he's in computers. Well, you're comparing him to Bill Gates or Steve Jobs? No, relative to those guys, Dennis Ritchie would be, well, if Steve Jobs was 10, Dennis Ritchie would be 100 when it comes to his importance in the world of computers and how it's affected our life. He's the one credited with creating the C programming language. Now, a lot of my fans are getting a little fuzzy. They're going, hey, Don, we don't know what programming languages are. What's C? To put it succinctly, C is probably the biggest, most used, most fundamental language used in computers. Every program you use, if it wasn't created in C, was created from a program related to C. It is the whole reason why we have computers and computers have become so useful today. Perhaps a good analogy is C is to the programming language what English is to international commerce. Even if not everyone speaks it, it is at some point at the root of the vast majority of international relations as we know it today. That's what Ritchie created. And this person that nobody knows about, no one has ever heard of Dennis Ritchie, and yet it is such a major fundamental aspect to the evolution of computers, it is surprising we don't know it. In fact, things like Windows would not exist without C. And, well, you don't know who he is. I think that's sad, and I thought I deserved to give him just a little bit of a shout-out. If only for a minute, he has a minute of fame, and you should all know the name Dennis Ritchie. I was going to do another little bit, and this will sound odd, but bear with me. What happened this week in 1752? And you might say, I don't know, Don. What happened in 1752? Well, if you were British, absolutely nothing. In fact, nothing could happen. It was in that year, 1752, that the British Empire decided to adopt the Gregorian calendar and abandon the Julian calendar. What that basically meant was Wednesday, September 2nd, 1752, was followed by Thursday, September 14th. 11 days just went poof. And thus, there was a whole well, almost 2 weeks that literally ceased to exist. And on that note now, I'm going to transfer over to a bit of web wisdom, and we're going to talk about some of the what topics I just sort of mentioned, but we're going to start off with a little bit about the Gregorian calendar and calendars in general. So let's listen in.
So why do we celebrate January 1st as the new year? Why are half of our months named after numbers and the other after Roman religious practices and leaders? Have we always counted days, weeks, months, and years like this? What's with that Mayan calendar thing? There were a number of calendars in early human history. You had the Hebrew calendar, the Egyptian calendar, the Greek calendar, Chinese calendar, Babylonian calendar, and others. The one we use today in the Western world originated from the Roman calendar. Incidentally, the early Roman calendar evolved from that of the Greeks. It was basically a lunar calendar with an extra month inserted every so often to keep the months in step with the seasons. They were named Martius, Aprilis, Maia, Junius, Quintilis, Sextilis, September, October, November, December, Januarius, and Februarius. These names have pretty much been the same since the past 2,500 years. Unlike today, the Roman year began with March. The calendar consisted of 355 days, which was about 12 lunar months. The intercalary month, Mercedonius, was added when needed at the end of February. So when that happened, February was shortened to 23 days. Julius Caesar took it upon himself to bring the calendar in line with the seasons. He ordered three intercalary months should be added at the end of the year, and rearranged the length of the months, giving them their present duration. He eventually rejected the lunar month entirely and adopted the solar year, which had an average length of 365.25 days. The four-year leap year cycle was added to resolve the 25th of a day. The reforms took place on January 1, 45 BCE. This changed the beginning of the year from March 1st to January 1st, as we know it today. The calendar was called the Julian calendar, for obvious reasons. The seven-day week was followed by Judaism and Islam. The week was set around a day of rest and religious practices. Romans didn't have a day of rest, so their eight-day week cycled around market days. Eventually, astrologers assigned a planet to rule each of the 24 hours of the day in a continual sequence. This led to the Roman seven-day cycle. Saturn, the Sun, Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, and Venus became Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. The names of the first 6 months are partially derived through the fact that certain Roman gods had feast days or time centered around them. For example, Janus was the god of beginning, so January was used for the name of the first month of the year. The month of March was the time that soldiers would begin war, so it was named after the god of war, Mars. The other 2 months were named after Roman leaders, and the rest of the months were just named after the number of the month that they were. October, 8th month, November, 9th month. The Julian calendar was simple, which made everything seem fine and dandy, but there was a small problem, a problem that added up every year. The 365.25 day year is 11 minutes and 15 seconds longer than the true length of the tropical year. After 128 years, the season begins a whole day earlier. The Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans didn't have an issue with days not lining up perfectly, but the Christian church did. You see, they wanted to make sure that the religious holidays they celebrated were on their actual days. Pope Gregory XIII took it upon himself to resolve this problem and came up with the Gregorian calendar. The changes he enacted resolved the shift at the beginning of each year, set a standard for the length of a year in days, minutes, and seconds, among other things. The changes were not accepted in England and the British colonies in America until 1752. By then, the English calendar was off by 11 days compared to the calendar of continental Europe. Because of this, dates of events such as the timeline of historical figures will often have two dates. The Gregorian is called the New Style and the Julian the Old Style. The birth of Isaac Newton was the 25th of December, 1642, in accordance to the old style, but was the 4th of January, 1643, in accordance to the new style. In the Middle Ages, New Year celebrations were abolished due to their pagan origins, but the celebrations were started again in 1582. The modern calendar can't be credited to one specific person. It's pretty much the Gregorian calendar, but with an addition of dates for Christian celebrations and the way years are numbered. Oh, and about the 2012 Mayan prophecy stating the end of the world, don't worry about that, it's a bunch of bunk.
As we already know, I was going to do a little bit here about the auto car or the Canadian Automotive Machine Gun Brigade, but only enough I couldn't find anything that really explains it. But what was really missing from that story or from that idea is a lot of us don't realize what impact horses had in World War I and World War II, but really in World War I. It has been estimated there was one horse to every three or four soldiers in World War I. Remember, this was a time when the automobile really hadn't taken off. And really, if you needed to move anything, supplies, guns, weapons, ammunition, you needed horses. There weren't a lot of roads. So the horse was the most important, perhaps, quote, machine in World War I. In fact, it's accredited to be one of the reasons why Germany lost, because with the blockade, there was no way for Germany to replenish its equine resource. Whereas Britain, France, and the rest of the world could call upon, well, the rest of the world. So I'm going to add a little bit of a documentary about the impact of horses and their suffering during World War I. Let's listen.
When the
Following the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo on the 28th of June 1914, one by one, the major military powers took up arms. As well as the men who fought, animals also played their part in the war. Without their help, we could have easily been defeated. Throughout history, mules and donkeys, as well as horses, have played an important role in war. About 6 million horses were sent to fight in the Great War, and only 62,000 came back. The proportion of animals in relation to fighting men during World War I was equal to one animal for every four men. Many different types of horses were used in the war, depending on the form of warfare. The type used varied whether the horse was being ridden or driven, and whether they were being used for reconnaissance, cavalry charges, raiding, communication, or supply. The horse, along with mules, was also used as a pack animal as it could carry more weight than the soldiers it travelled with. Most transportation lines, especially road and railways, could not withstand artillery bombardments which destroyed the ground. But horses were able to cope in the conditions and carried ammunition and supplies between the surviving road, railheads and rear trenches, though the horse generally wasn't used in the trench zone. The role of the horse was crucial in keeping the supply line constant. Soldiers depended on these animals to transport ammunition, weaponry, ration carts, as well as moving ambulances through the day and night. This they did through constantly shelled, muddy ground, which was impassable for wheel transport. Animals were necessary for these treacherous and hostile conditions. Horses weren't the only animals used in the war. Other animals, such as mules, dogs, elephants, camels, pigeons, and even canaries were used. Of these horses, only those reaching a certain criteria were used in the war, an example of which is no horse under 15 hands would be called to active service. Mainly cobs and shire horses were used to pull big heavy carts because of their build. One of the greatest threats to these animals wasn't artillery or gunfire, but disease and infection. Many horses in the war became severely ill due to the conditions they survived in, and some common types of infections they got were thrush, because they were standing in filthy conditions and the bacteria began to grow. Mud fever. They got this from the severe mud conditions they had to walk through and live in. Rain scald. Most of the horses were pulling carts in the rain and had no protection most of the time and developed rain scald. Underweight. Many horses were barely fed in the war and lost lots of weight through sweat and hard work. Laminitis was one of the most common problems soldiers had to deal with, a very painful circulatory disorder of the laminae within the hoof that affects interlaminal bond between the pedal bone and hoof wall. Stress, trauma, obesity, toxemia and hormones can all be triggering factors. Cuts. Simple cuts that the horses got while travelling and had to put up with the pain because the soldiers didn't do health checks on them. In serious cases, the horse would either die through the night or have to be put down. Soldiers would often overload their horses and neglected their health, with saddle sores being a common problem, along with colic, as the soldiers would misfeed the horses. The main cause of a horse's death was cavalry charges. Soldiers would charge their horse towards gunfire and try to kill their opponent. Unfortunately, many of these charges ended in both of their deaths. Other cavalry charges ended from the horse and rider getting caught in barbed wire, and with no way of rescuing them, both would eventually die a horrible, lonely death. For the horses that survived the war, the outlook was still grim. They were left in fields as it was too costly for the government to bring them home. Their owners would travel to France, and if they could prove the horse was theirs, they would be allowed to take them back. All of the unwanted horses would either be sent for slaughter and fed to the soldiers, or left to die in the field if they weren't good enough to be butchered. Of those horses that did return, many were psychologically traumatized and couldn't adapt to their surroundings, and so were eventually put to sleep.
And on that somber note, we'll be back after this break.
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle. A tax-deductible receipt. And a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
Okay, so we're back. Everyone's wondered about human evolution and what it's all about. Well, I found this little bit of web wisdom from SciShow about the facts of human evolution. So let's take a moment and listen.
Imagine the scene. It was 1871 and Charles Darwin had just suggested that we humans did not, in fact, walk fully formed out of the primordial sludge at the beginning of time. Instead, in his book, The Descent of Man, he proposed that humans descended from African apes.
Naturally, his Victorian contemporaries were all, "Oh, fetch me my smelling salts," and clutching at their pearls and whatnot.
And maybe you can't blame him for being shocked, because Darwin's idea is still shocking people, like 140 years later. But, as he often was, Darwin was right. The amazing thing is that he proposed his theory of human evolution when there was almost no fossil evidence of any other kinds of hominins. That includes us and our ape-like ancestors on Earth. It took another 50 years for enough fossils to pile up to start corroborating Darwin's theory, and another several decades to piece together, compare, and argue about how these species related to each other. Actually, that's a process that's still going on right now. These days, about 24 hominin species or possible species have been identified, and while the hominin family tree looks sort of like a prickly bush at the moment, taken together, these fossils do show us how our ape-like ancestors evolved into modern human awesomeness. See, on the journey from genus Australopithecus to the genus Homo, our ancestors reached a series of game-changing evolutionary benchmarks, whether they were acquired traits or new behaviors that gave its species a huge advantage over the previous ones. We exist largely because of those evolutionary breakthroughs. So, what are they? And who else is in our family bush? And will this be on the final? Follow me into the facts of human evolution. Our understanding of where we came from has changed dramatically in just the last 50 years. If you were a paleoanthropologist working in the 1970s, you probably believed that there were a bunch of different human species running around on Earth for millions of years, and that they all sort of interbred when they bumped into each other. This is known as the multi-regional hypothesis, and it suggested that Neanderthals in Europe, for example, evolved into modern Europeans, while Homo erectus in China would have been the predecessor of modern Asians, and that Java man found in Indonesia would have been the ancestor to Australian Aboriginal peoples. These days, multi-regionalism has fallen out of favor, mostly because in the 1980s, researchers started studying mitochondrial DNA. That's the ancient DNA found in the mitochondria of our cells, which is totally separate from the DNA in our cells' nuclei. That's the stuff that we inherit from both of our parents. Mitochondrial DNA, on the other hand, is passed down only from the mothers to their offspring, and by following its various mutations over time and across populations, scientists have been able to track the migration of humans over the past 200,000 years, all the way back to a single ancestral population of modern humans in Africa. This genetic evidence, combined with the fact that all of the oldest hominin fossils have come from Africa, led to the out-of-Africa hypothesis, which suggests that anatomically modern humans evolved exclusively in Africa and then spread across the world in two different waves. One wave, which happened anywhere from 70,000 to 125,000 years ago, took a right-hand turn out of Africa, populating the Middle East, Asia, Indonesia, and Australia. The second wave happened much later and headed straight up through Europe. So that's currently the most popular idea about where we came from, but when it comes to how hominins evolved, there are only a few things we're sure about. For starters, there did used to be a lot of different species of people running around, and now there's only one. And though we share the vast majority of our DNA with chimps, our common ancestor with them probably lived about 7 million years ago, maybe more. It was about 1 million years after that break with chimps that the Homo sapiens saga really began, when a segment of an ancient population of apes acquired the first real breakthrough in human evolution bipedalism. This is when apes somewhat obviously started walking upright and on 2 feet. There were a couple of different early semi-bipedal genera of apes, and these probably evolved into the Australopithecines, who we can call Grandma and Grandpa. Australopithecines weren't that different from other ancient African apes. They were about the same size, and they had the same size brains. In fact, the first Australopithecines, like Lucy, the 3.2-million-year-old Australopithecus afarensis fossil found in Ethiopia in 1974, was probably about a meter tall and didn't look too different from a modern chimp. But we know that Lucy walked upright due to the shape of her bones, and because we found fossilized footprints of her buddies. And though there are a few different theories behind why bipedalism may have evolved, it seems to have happened just as the dense African forests were shrinking due to climate change. So early hominins may have been forced out onto the grasslands where bipedalism made it easier to spot predators, to travel long distances, and to pick fruit off trees. But bipedalism was most important because it freed up two of our limbs. When you got two hands just hanging out not doing anything, the next obvious step is to pick up a rock, start smashing stuff. And voila! You got an ape using a tool. And this led to the second major characteristic to advance human evolution, a precision grip. As hominins evolved, they used their hands more and more for gripping and manipulating small objects, then swinging through trees and what have you. So, over time, the big curved hands that we associate with chimps and gorillas were replaced with smaller, more nimble hands with powerful thumbs that you could see at the end of your arms right now. These hands were better suited for using slicing tools, and our first tool-making ancestor may have been Homo habilis, aka Handyman. Homo habilis is the first obviously human-like hominin in the fossil record, and he's thought to be the earliest member of the Homo genus. He first appeared about 2.4 million years ago and was probably the direct descendant of the Australopithecines. I have to say probably because, you know, I wasn't there and there will always be holes in the fossil record. And Homo habilis probably couldn't have fixed your dishwasher, but he could totally have smashed it to pieces with a rock. In addition to acquiring more dexterous hands, Homo habilis ate meat. Its omnivorous diet was a new thing for previously vegetarian hominins, and it turned out to be another game-changer for the genus Homo, because it kick-started the process of encephalization, or the growth of the brain in relation to the overall body mass. See, building and maintaining brains requires a ton of calories, so even though the first omnivorous hominins were probably scavenging gazelle scraps from saber-toothed cats or something, meat was a big enough part of their diet that their brain size increased pretty rapidly. Some argue that Homo habilis was also probably the first human ancestor to figure out how to cook food. Cooking unlocks all sorts of calories and nutrients from vegetables and tubers, as well as making rotten scavenged meat less dangerous. So overall nutrition for these guys improved a lot around this time, and brains, as a result, got bigger. But it wasn't just brain size that evolved, the pattern of brain growth was really important too. Over time, our ancestors' temporal lobes, which house the centers for language processing, and the prefrontal cortices, which help with complex decision-making and moderating social behavior, grew disproportionately to the other parts of their brains. Some researchers think this had a lot to do with the vastly improved diet, and at the same time, a need to solve social problems, which was becoming more and more important. One reason for this can be found in the fossils of Homo ergaster, which came on the scene around 1.65 million years ago. A lot of people think it's the descendant of Homo habilis. They looked even more like modern humans than Homo habilis. They had smaller jaws and sharper teeth, and were taller and more slender. They were also probably the first mostly hairless hominins. But one very interesting detail is that Homo ergaster had hips so narrow as to make the unassisted delivery of a baby very difficult. And since ergaster had bigger brains, their babies' heads were probably also considerably larger than those of past hominin babies. So, baby heads were getting bigger as females' pelvises were getting smaller. The only solution was for babies to be born before their brains were fully formed so that they could pass through the birth canal. But this meant that after birth, babies were less developed, requiring more care than ever, and for a longer time. This required ergaster and later members of the Homo genus to develop another breakthrough that could only be possible with big, sophisticated brains. I'm talking, of course, about complex social behavior. More so than anyone who came before them, members of Homo ergaster really needed each other. For delivering each other's babies, for caring for babies that took freaking forever to mature, for finding enough food to sustain everybody, and for hunting, which ergaster probably did in groups. It's also possible that Homo ergaster was the first human to to leave Africa, maybe in search of better hunting grounds. Ergaster bones, dated to around 1.75 million years ago, have been found around the border of Armenia and Georgia. Shortly afterward, we start seeing the genus Homo erectus, the first early human whose fossils have been found in large numbers outside of Africa. And it seems like they did really well for themselves. Erectus laid tracks from Africa throughout much of Asia between 1.8 and 1.5 million years ago, and only went extinct around 27,000 years ago. They may even have been the first species to make sea voyages and build shelters for themselves. Homo erectus was kind of my favorite grandpa, or maybe great-uncle, nobody's sure. Because during the heyday of Homo erectus, about 400,000 to 600,000 years ago, we begin to see another species of hominin, Homo heidelbergensis, which some believe to be the direct descendant of Homo ergaster, since they were very similar, with a couple of exceptions. Heidelbergensis had a much larger brain than ergaster. Some fossil skulls suggest that their brains could have been about as big as modern humans, and they seem to have been much more socially advanced. For instance, some scientists believe that Heidelbergensis was the first hominin species to bury their dead. But possibly the most important thing about Homo heidelbergensis is that many believe it's the direct predecessor to modern Homo sapiens, and possibly also to our thick-browed cousins, the Neanderthals, aka Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, or Homo neanderthalensis. One theory is that a population of heidelbergensis remained in Africa, and modern humans descended from them, while other heidelbergensis hoofed it up through Europe, and Neanderthals derived from that group. This, like many other things in human evolution, is hotly contested. What we do know is that Neanderthals and modern humans actually hung out together for about 30,000 years. Neanderthals lived across Europe from 200,000 to 28,000 years ago, and though they had pronounced brow ridges and were heavier set than we are, they looked pretty similar to modern humans. Their brains seem to have been a bit larger than ours, and modern humans and Neanderthals apparently shared some cultural habits, like burying our dead, making art, and using tools to beat the crap out of each other. And of course, they totally found some time to get it on with each other. We've been able to reconstruct almost the entire Neanderthal genome, and it turns out that about 2.5% of our DNA is from some Neanderthals who, I guess, some of our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers spent a crazy night with in a cave in Israel. So that brings us up through modern humans, but the story of our ancestry is always changing, because exciting discoveries are being made all the time. For instance, in 2004, researchers found fossils of Homo floresiensis, aka the Hobbit, a tiny person that lived until about 13,000 years ago in what is now Indonesia. Even more recently, in 2008, fossils of a new people, the Denisovans, or Denisova hominin, were discovered, who researchers think may have overlapped and possibly interbred with modern humans. And the discovery of Australopithecus sediba, also in 2008, has some paleoanthropologists in a dither about whether it could be the real direct progenitor for the genus Homo and also the first toolmaker. So it's an exciting time to be researching our origins. Nobody's really sure what killed off these other species. Some theories suggest it was climate change or a catastrophic event like a supervolcano eruption, or simply not being able to compete with this. Maybe we are the survivors because of our big brains, because we had to evolve to help each other out, and because we eventually developed agriculture about 10,000 years ago, which caused a huge population explosion that is still going on today. But now, it's just us, which makes me a little bit sad. It's pretty strange to think that if we went back in time just 100,000 years, like yesterday afternoon, geologically speaking, we'd be sharing the Earth with six different kinds of humans. Something tells me that playing Mario Party with a Neanderthal would be like a dozen different kinds of awesome, but I guess I'll never know.
We'll be back after this break.
SpongeBob! You're wasting me precious carbon dioxide! I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy! Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool!
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable! Big business does it again!
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
And we're back. Well, I'm going to play a little treat that I found on the internet and I just loved. It's one of Tim Mitchin's greatest videos. It's called The Storm, saying things that we skeptics just try not to say because we don't want to become social pariahs, but it's all on our minds. So let's listen to Tim Mitchin's The Storm.
Inner North London, top floor flat, all white walls, white carpet, white cat, rice paper partitions, modern art and ambition. The host's a physician, bright bloke, has his own practice, his girlfriend's an actress, an old maid of ours from home, and they're always great fun, so to dinner we've come. The fifth guest is an unknown. The hosts have just thrown us together for a favour, because this girl's just arrived from Australia and she's moved to North London and she's the sister of someone or has some connection. As we make introductions, I'm struck by her beauty. She's irrefutably fair, with dark eyes and dark hair. But as she sits, I admit I'm a little bit wary, because I notice the tip of the wing of a fairy tattooed on that popular area just above the derriere, and when she says, "I'm Sagittarian," I confess a pigeonhole starts to form, and is immediately filled with pigeon when she says her name is Storm. Conversation is initially bright and light-hearted, but it's not long before Storm gets started. "You can't know anything. Knowledge is merely opinion," she opines over her Cabernet Sauvignon vis-a-vis some unhippily empirical comment made by me. Not a good start, I think. We're only on pre-dinner drinks, and across the room my wife widens her eyes, silently begs me, "Be nice." A matrimonial warning not worth ignoring, so I resist the urge to ask Storm whether knowledge is so loose weave of a morning when deciding whether to leave her apartment by the front door or the window on her second floor. The food is delicious, and Storm, whilst avoiding all meat, happily sits and eats as the good doctor, slightly pissedly, holds court on some anachronistic aspect of medical history when Storm suddenly insists, "But the human body is a mystery. Science just falls in a hole when it tries to explain the nature of the soul." My hostess throws me a glance. She, like my wife, knows there's a chance I'll be off on one of my rare but fun rants, but I shan't. My lips are sealed. I just want to enjoy the meal, and although Storm is starting to get my goat, I have no intention of rocking the boat. Although it's becoming a bit of a wrestle, because like her meteorological namesake, Storm has no such concerns for our vessel. "Pharmaceutical companies are the enemy. They promote drug dependency at the cost of the natural remedies that are all our bodies need. They are immoral and driven by greed. Why take drugs when herbs can solve it? Why use chemicals when homeopathic solvents can resolve it? I think it's time we all return to live with natural medical alternatives." And try as I like, a small crack appears in my diplomacy dike. "By definition," I begin, "alternative medicine," I continue, "has either not been proved to work or been proved not to work. Do you know what they call alternative medicine that's been proved to work? Medicine." "So you don't believe in any natural remedies?" "On the contrary, Storm, actually, before I came to tea, I took a remedy derived from the bark of a willow tree, a painkiller that's virtually side effect free. It's got a weird name. Darling, what was it again? Maspirin? Baspirin? Oh yes, aspirin, which I paid about $1 for down at the local drugstore." The debate briefly abates as my hosts collect plates, but when they return with desserts, Storm pertly asserts, "Shakespeare said it first. There are more things in heaven and earth than exist in your philosophy. Science is just how we're trained to look at reality. It doesn't explain love or spirituality. How does science explain psychics, auras, the afterlife, the power of prayer?" I'm becoming aware that I'm staring. I'm like a rabbit suddenly trapped in the blinding headlights of vacuous crap. Maybe it's the Hamlet she just misquaffed, or the fifth glass of wine I just quaffed, but my diplomacy dyke groans, and the asshole held back by its stones can be held back no more. Look, Storm, sorry, I don't mean to bore you, but there's no such thing as an aura. Reading auras is like reading minds, or tea leaves, or star signs, or meridian lines. These people aren't plying a skill. They're either lying or mentally ill. Same goes for people who claim they can hear God's demands, or spiritual healers who think they've got magic hands. By the way, why do we think it's okay for people to pretend they can talk to the dead? Isn't that totally fucked in the head? Lying to some crying woman whose child has died and telling her you're in touch with the other side? I think that's fundamentally sick. Do we need to clarify here that there's no such thing as a psychic? What are we fucking to? Do we actually think that Horton heard a who? Do we still believe that Santa brings us gifts? That Michael Jackson didn't have facelifts? Are we still so stunned by circus tricks that we think the dead would want to talk to pricks like John Edward? Storm, to her credit, despite my derision, keeps firing off cliches with startling precision, like a sniper using bollocks for ammunition. You're so sure of your position, but you're just closed-minded. I think you'll find that your faith in science and tests is just as blind as the faith of any fundamentalist. Wow, that's a good point. Let me think for a bit. Oh, wait, my mistake. That's absolute bullshit. Science adjusts its views based on what's observed. Faith is the denial of observations so that belief can be preserved. If you show me that, say, homeopathy works, then I will change my mind. I will spin on a fucking dime. I'll be as embarrassed as hell, yet I will run through the streets yelling, "It's a miracle! Take physics and bin it! Water has memory, and whilst its memory of a long-lost drop of onion juice seems infinite, it somehow forgets all the poo it's had in it. You show me that it works, and how it works, and when I've recovered from the shock, I will take a compass and carve fancy that on the side of my cock." Everyone's just staring now, but I'm pretty pissed and I've dug this far down, so I figure in for a penny, in for a pound. Life is full of mysteries, yeah, but there are answers out there and they won't be found by people sitting around looking serious and saying, "Isn't life mysterious? Let's sit here and hope. Let's call up the fucking Pope. Let's go watch Oprah interview Deepak Chopra." If you want to watch telly, you should watch Scooby-Doo. That show was so cool because every time there was a church with a ghoul or a ghost in a school, they looked beneath the mask. And what was inside? The fucking janitor or the dude who ran the water slide. Because throughout history, every mystery ever solved has turned out to be not magic. Does the idea that there might be knowledge frighten you? Does the idea that one afternoon on Wikifuckingpedia might enlighten you frighten you? Does the notion that there might not be a supernatural so blow your hippie noodle that you'd rather just stand in the fog of your inability to Google? Isn't this enough? Just this world? Just this? Beautiful, complex, wonderfully unfathomable natural world? How does it so fail to hold our attention that we have to diminish it with the invention of cheap, man-made myths and monsters? If you're so into your Shakespeare, lend me your ear. To gild refined gold, to paint the lily, to throw perfume on the violet, is just fucking silly. Or something like that. Or what about Satchmo? "I see trees of green, red roses too." And fine if you wish to glorify Krishna and Vishnu in a post-colonial, condescending, bottled up and labeled kind of way, then whatever, that's okay. But here's what gives me a hard-on. I am a tiny, insignificant, ignorant bit of carbon. I have one life, and it is short and unimportant. But thanks to recent scientific advances, I get to live twice as long as my great-great-great-great uncles and aunts. Twice as long to live this life of mine. Twice as long to love this wife of mine. Twice as many years of friends and wine, of sharing curries and getting shitty at good-looking hippies with fairies on their spines and butterflies on their titties. And if, perchance, I have offended, think but this and all is mended. We'd as well be 10 minutes back in time for all the chance you'll change your mind.
We're going to close the show with a bit from Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. I think it's a really great show, and you should really tune in and listen to it. It's on HBO, or you can just borrow it from YouTube or iTunes or Pirate Bay. But here's a satirical and yet somewhat serious look at space geckos and sex. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on, and enjoy John Oliver.
Finally tonight, before we go, you might remember that a little over a month ago, I brought to your attention the single most urgent crisis of our time.
Russia has lost contact with a satellite full of possibly mating geckos. They were trying to observe their mating activities in zero gravity. But after just a few orbits, their pod stopped responding to mission control.
It was terrifying. Now, you may remember that in response to that, we launched our famous hashtag Go Get Those Geckos campaign, uniting all fans of astro-reptilian fornication from across the globe. And soon after we launched our campaign, it seemed that we were victorious. We even released a web video announcing the good news. Russia has regained communication with their interstellar orgy mobile. Ladies and gentlemen, we did it! The geckos got docked! Woo! 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 Oh, I remember those days. Such pure distilled joy. Well, it turns out I may have been a little premature because the satellite landed earlier this week and Russia had a tragic announcement to make.
Russian officials say 5 geckos that were sent to space have died.
No! Do you know what? I would ask for a moment of silence, but that's frankly not enough. In honor of the 5 brave geckos who lost their lives, please join me in 5 mournful flicks of the tongue. Okay, look, I want answers now. I want answers. How did this happen?
Apparently, they froze to death because of equipment failure. On the bright side, fruit flies on that same mission survived.
Who gives a shit? I don't care about the fruit flies. I only care about the frozen fuck lizards. Listen, up in that shuttle, there were 4 females and 1 male. And we sent those geckos to have sex in space, not because they were easy, but because he was hard. This is devastating. And these brave, horny space reptiles deserve a dignified send-off. Those geckos may not have been able to speak English because they were Russian. And they may not have been able to speak Russian because they were geckos. But I am sure that they could understand the universal language of music. So with that in mind, to help me honor their memory, singing their hit song Say Something, please welcome A Great Big World.
Say something, I'm giving up on you.
We're all going to miss those horny little f*** lizards.
Sorry that I couldn't get to you.
But let's remember they died doing what they loved. Fucking in space.
Anywhere I would have followed you.
And I know that right now, they're up in heaven, right up there.
Say something, I'm giving up on you.
And they are having high-pitched sex on the ceiling of God's bedroom.
And I swallow my pride. You're the one I love. I say goodbye. Say something, I'm giving up on you. Sorry
for watching. My deep thanks to A Great Big World. Please, please do join us next week. Good night to you.
Say something.
Thank you.